Committee Process. The cherry trees are in bloom in Washington, D.C., and Gregor perspires in the summer heat. He has grown used to the relative cool of London, and this unaccustomed change of climate has disoriented him. Jet lag is a thing of the past, a small mercy, but there are still adjustments to make. Because the disk is flat, the daylight source, polar flares from an accretion disk inside the axial hole, the scientists call it, which signifies nothing to most people, grows and shrinks the same wherever you stand. There's a concrete 60s vintage office block with a conference suite furnished in burnt umber and orange, chromed chairs and Kandinsky prints on the walls, all very 70s. Gregor waits outside the suite until the buzzer sounds and the receptionist looks up from behind her IBM typewriter and says, "You can go in now. They're expecting you." Gregor goes in. It's an occupational hazard, but by no means the worst in his line of work.
"Have a seat."
It's Seth Brundle, Gregor's divisional head, a gray-looking functionary, more adept at office backstabbing than field expedient assassinations. His cover, like Gregor's, is an innocuous-sounding post in the Office of Technology Assessment. In fact, both he and Gregor work for a different government agency, although the notional task is the same: identify technological threats and stamp on them before they emerge. Brundle is not alone in the room. He proceeds with the introductions.
"Greg Samsa is our London station chief and specialist in scientific intelligence. Greg, this is Marcus."
The bald, thin-faced German in the smart suit bobs his head and smiles behind his horn-rimmed glasses.
"Civilian consultant."
Gregor mistrusts him on sight. Marcus is a defector, a former Stasi spook from back before the Brezhnev purges of the mid-60s, which puts an interesting complexion on this meeting.
"Murray Fox, from Langley."
"Hi," says Gregor, wondering just what kind of insane political critical mass Stone is trying to assemble. Langley and Brundle's parent outfit aren't even on speaking terms, to say the least.
"And another civilian specialist, Dr. Sagan."
Greg nods at the doctor, a thin guy with sparkling brown eyes and hippie-ish long hair.
"Greg's got something to tell us in person," says Brundle. "Something very interesting he picked up in London. No sources, please, Greg."
"No sources,"
Gregor echoes. He pulls out a chair and sits down. Now that he's here, he supposes he'll just have to play the role Brundle assigned to him in the confidential briefing he read on the long flight home.
"We have word from an unimpeachable human resource that the Russians have..."
He coughs into his fist.
"Excuse me."
He glances at Brundle.
"Okay to talk about Collection Ruby?"
"They're all cleared," Brundle says dryly. "That's why it says Joint Committee on the letterhead."
"I see. My invitation was somewhat terse."
Gregor stifles a sigh that seems to say, "All I get is a most urgent recall. How am I meant to know what's going on, and who knows what?"
"So why are we here?"
"Think of it as another collective analysis board,"
says Fox, the man from the CIA. He doesn't look enthused.
"We're here to find out what's going on, with the benefit of some intelligence resources from the other side of the curtain."
Dr. Sagan, who has been listening silently with his head cocked to one side like a very intelligent blackbird, raises an eyebrow.
"Yes?"
asks Brundle.
Would you mind explaining that to me? I haven't been on one of these committees before."
No, indeed, thinks Gregor. It's a miracle Sagan ever passed his political vetting. He's too friendly by far with some of those Russian astronomer guys who are clearly under the thumb of the KGB's First Department. And he's expressed doubts, muted, of course, about the thrust of current foreign policy, which is a serious no-no under the McNamara administration.
"A CAB is a joint committee feeding into the Central Office of Information's external bureaus on behalf of a blue-ribbon panel of experts assembled from the intelligence community,"
Gregor recites in a bored tone of voice.
"Stripped of the bullshit, we're a board of wise men who are meant to rise above narrow bureaucratic lines of engagement and prepare a report for the Office of Technology Assessment to pass on to the Director of Central Intelligence. It's not meant to reflect the agenda of any one department, but to be a Delphi board synergizing our lateralities. Set up after the Cuban fiasco to make sure that we never again get backed into that kind of corner by accidental groupthink." One of the rules of the cab process is that it has to include at least one dissident. Unlike the commies, we know we're not perfect.
Gregor glances pointedly at Fox, who has the good sense to stay silent.
Oh, I see, Sagan says hesitantly,
with more force.
So that's why I'm here? Is that the only reason you've dragged me away from Cornell?
Of course not, Doctor, oozes Brundle, casting Gregor a dirty look. The East German defector, Wolf, maintains a smug silence. I am above all this.
We're here to come up with policy recommendations for dealing with the bigger picture. The much bigger picture.
The builders, says Fox. We're here to determine what our options look like, if and when they show up, and to make recommendations about the appropriate course of action. Your background in, SETI recommended you.
Sagan looks at him in disbelief.
I'd have thought that was obvious, he says.
Eh?
We won't have any choice,
the young professor explains with a wry smile.
Does a termite mound negotiate with a nuclear superpower?
Brundle leans forward.
That's a rather radical position, isn't it? Surely there'll be some room for maneuver. We know this is an artificial construct, but presumably the builders are still leaving people, even if they've got green skin and six eyes.
Oh. My. God.
Sagan leans forward, his face in his hands. After a moment, Gregor realizes that he's laughing.
Excuse me.
Gregor glances round. It's the German defector, Wolf, or whatever he's called.
Herr Professor, would you care to explain what you find so funny?
After a moment, Sagan leans back, looks at the ceiling, and sighs.
Imagine a single, a 45 RPM record with a center hole punched out. The inner hole is half an astronomical unit, 46 million miles in radius. The outer edge is of unknown radius, but probably about 2.5 AUs, 245 million miles. The disk's thickness is unknown. Seismic waves are reflected off a mirror-like rigid layer 800 miles down, but we can estimate it at 8,000 miles, if its density averages out at the same as Earth's. Surface gravity is the same as our original planet, and since we've been transplanted here and survived, we have learned that it's a remarkably hospitable environment for our kind of life. Only on the large scale does it seem different.
The astronomer sits up.
Do any of you gentlemen have any idea just how preposterously powerful whoever built this structure is?
How do you mean preposterously powerful?
Asks Brundle, looking more interested than annoyed.
A colleague of mine, Dan Alderson, did the first analysis. I think you might have done better to pull him in, frankly. Anyway, let me itemize. Item number one is escape velocity.
Sagan holds up a bony finger.
Gravity on a disk does not diminish in accordance with the inverse square law the way it does on a spherical object like the planet we came from. We have roughly Earth-like gravity, but to escape, or to reach orbit, takes tremendously more speed. Roughly 200 times more, in fact. Rockets that from Earth could reach the moon just fall out of the sky after running out of fuel. Next item.
Another finger.
The area and mass of the disk. If it's double-sided, it has a surface area equal to billions and billions of Earths. We're stuck in the middle of an ocean full of alien continents, but we have no guarantee that this hospitable environment is anything other than a tiny oasis in a world of strangeness.
The astronomer pauses to pour himself a glass of water, then glances round the table.
To put it in perspective, gentlemen, this world is so big that if one in every 100 stars had an Earth-like planet, this single structure could support the population of our entire home galaxy. As for the mass, this structure is as massive as 50,000 suns. It is, quite bluntly, impossible. As yet unknown physical forces must be at work to keep it from rapidly collapsing in on itself and creating a black hole. The repulsive force, whatever it is strong enough to hold the weight of 50,000 suns. Think about that for a moment, gentlemen.
At that point, Sagan looks around and notices the blank stares. He chuckles ruefully.
What I mean to say is, this structure is not permitted by the laws of physics as we understand them. Because it clearly does exist,
we can draw some conclusions, starting with the fact that our understanding of physics is incomplete. Well, that isn't news. We know we don't have a unified theory of everything. Einstein spent 30 years looking for one and didn't come up with it. But, secondly, he looks tired for a moment, aged beyond his years. We used to think that any extraterrestrial beings we might communicate with would be fundamentally comprehensible. Folks like us, albeit with better technology. I think that's the frame of mind you're still working in. Back in 61, we had a brainstorming session at a conference, trying to work out just how big an engineering project a spacefaring civilization might come up with. Freeman Dyson from Princeton came up with about the biggest thing any of us could imagine, something that required us to imagine dismantling Jupiter and turning it into habitable real estate. This disk is about 100 million times bigger than Dyson's sphere, and that's before we take into account the time factor.
Time?
Echoes Fox from Langley, sounding confused.
Time.
Sagan smiles in a vaguely disconnected way. We're nowhere near our original galactic neighborhood, and whoever moved us here, they didn't bend the laws of physics far enough to violate the speed limit. It takes light about 160,000 years to cross the distance between where we used to live and our new stellar neighborhood, the Lesser Magellanic Cloud, which we have fixed, incidentally, by measuring the distance to known Cepheid variables, once we were able to take into account the measurable blue shift of infalling light and the fact that some of them were changing frequency slowly and seemed to have changed rather a lot. Our best estimate is 800,000 years, plus or minus 200,000. That's about 4 times as long as our species has existed, gentlemen. We're fossils, an archaeology experiment or something. Our relevance to our abductors is not as equals, but as subjects in some kind of vast experiment. And what the purpose of the experiment is, I can't tell you. I've got some guesses, but... Sagan shrugs, then lapses into silence. Gregor catches Brundle's eye, and Brundle shakes his head very slightly. Don't spill the beans. Gregor nods. Sagan may realize he's in a room with a CIA spook and an East German defector, but he doesn't need to know about the alienation service yet.
Well, that's as may be,
says Fox, dropping words like stones into the hollow silence at the table.
But it begs the question, what are we going to tell the DCI?
I suggest, says Gregor, that we start by reviewing Collection Ruby.
He nods at Sagan.
Then, maybe when we're all up to speed on that, we'll have a better idea of whether there's anything useful we can tell the DCI.